Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. My name is Karen. This is episode number 33. I did that in a different order today, and I'm joined by Kristen.
It's weird once you, like, start doing something. Yeah. And you're like, that's not how I always do it.
Yeah.
Why did I do it that way? This feels weird, but you're too far in to, like, change it. So it's like, all right, here we go.
Yeah, just gonna roll with it. We do that a lot on Rewatchable, where, like, we kind of just started doing the same intro every time and, like, certain things at the end every time. And if we didn't do it, like, nobody knew how to handle it. It
right.
was very funny. Podcasting is a weird business.
It really is. So odd.
If you would like to contact us, please do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. I am very excited for today's episode because we are going to be talking about Ballad and Dagger, and we are going to be interviewing Daniel Jose Older. So woo-hoo. That's been a thing that's been on the calendar for a while now, and we're finally here, so I'm very, very excited about that. But before we get to all that fun stuff, we have other fun stuff. I didn't want to pick and choose. News is still fun. We don't have a lot this week, though. We finished out last Olympian week. It's over. It's done. It's gone.
Sad.
Yeah.
Tears. I've lost the ability to not be a caption today. Real sentences are evading me, so just tears is all I've got.
But it was a lot of fun, and I'm really hoping that we can do that again for, like, Heroes of Olympus or, you know, like, some of the other stuff.
Yeah, especially, like, give us 6 months or so, I would love to do it for Heroes of Olympus or go back to doing the character days, because we had Grover Day or Grover Week.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And
Grover
I would love
appreciation.
Yeah, and I would love to, like, you know, do an Annabeth appreciation coming up here and do a Percy. I guess Percy gets one. He wants.
He wants.
But, I mean, that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be cool to jump over to King Chronicles, too, since that movie's coming out.
And oh, yeah.
I feel like it would be a good time for something like that. Disney Upfront event is going on. Is still going on right now? I think it is.
It's usually a couple of days. I don't know if it's currently going on, but yeah, it was a thing at least.
Yeah. I did see that Daredevil is back in the works at Disney Plus, though, so
yes, I saw that, too.
Very excited.
Yes.
Very excited.
I knew you would be.
In terms of Percy Jackson, though, nothing really happening. So Walker was at the event, but we didn't get, like, anything yet. I don't know. Again, I don't know if it's still going on or what, if we'll get something else. But we had talked previously about, like, oh, well, we get, like, a little title intro or, like, a little glimpse at some monster previs or something like that. And nothing really came out other than this sort of clickbaity headline from People that says, Walker Scobell says, former Percy Jackson stars haven't contacted him. I'd love to hear from Logan Lerman. And I don't know why, but I read it as, like, kind of a sassy headline. And I was like, I know Walker didn't say it that way. And he didn't. Like, somebody did ask him if they reached out to him. And he said, not yet. And he went, I really hope they do. That would be really cool. I'd like to hear some advice from Logan Lerman. I really liked his Percy Jackson, which feels to me like a bit of a softer headline.
Oh, yeah.
So,
he's just saying, oh, yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Like, as a fan of the books and a fan of the people who've played it before, like,
right.
I get it. But, yeah, it's like they set him up for it, and then it was like, haha.
Which happens all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's just how headlines are these days.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it sounded more like, no, I haven't heard from them, hint, hint, they should contact me, versus, like, it would be really cool if they did, you know?
Yeah.
So, but that was the only thing that really came out of the Disney upfronts about Percy Jackson or Walker or anything like that. And yeah, so we don't really have a whole lot to report on there, unfortunately. Would have been cool to have something else, but we're still not even in filming, so I'm not surprised that there wasn't anything.
Yeah, as much as it would have been really cool to get some, you know, not even, like, previs stuff with, you know, because that stuff can look kind of weird sometimes, but, like, just the like artistic renderings or something of what they're working on with the monsters or something like that.
Concept art.
What? Yeah. Yes, that's it.
That's the word we were looking for.
That's the word that's been evading me all week. Concept art. Yeah, like it would have been really great to see something like that, but they may not be there yet. I mean, they've been focused on casting for the last, you know, 3, 4, or 5 weeks now, like trying to get all the smaller roles filled and all of the, you know, principles that are, now that we've got the trio, they're working on the rest. So I totally get it. It's totally fine. But it would have been cool. I'm glad they invited Walker. I'm glad he was there. You know, if something does pop up, because again, I'm not sure if it's over, we'll probably, you know, we'll be all over that. But yeah.
Okay, and our last bit of news, we don't have 18 things to talk about and 3 blog posts.
Because Rick didn't post this.
Yeah, really. But I am actually very excited about this. So we got the cover reveal for Winston Chu versus the Whimsies by Stacy Lee. And I am kind of obsessed with this cover.
Ooh.
I think it's so cute. The illustrator is Amber Wren, and you should go follow her on Twitter because she has like a really cool style. The book comes out on February 7th, and I don't know, it's got this like cartoonish, like it gives me vibes, but I don't know what the vibes it gives me. I feel like I kind of recognize what this looks like, and it gives me like some sort of nostalgic vibes for something, but I can't figure out what.
The closest thing I can think of with the art style is a little bit like that animated adaptation of A Little Prince. I think it was on Netflix from a couple years ago.
I saw that and cried my eyes out.
Yeah, I read it in French. In the original, I think original French. In my French class in high school. Trust me, not an upper. Good story, not an upper.
Beautiful movie, but you will cry.
Right. The art style kind of reminds me a little bit of that. That's the closest thing I can think of. Mm. But yeah, there is something very familiar about it. Maybe it's the red hoodie broom thing. Maybe it's reminding me of Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yeah, that's what where my mind went to.
I mean, maybe it's something like that. I don't know. But yeah, it definitely is giving really fun, very interesting. Are those eyeballs?
Where?
Right above Chu?
Oh.
Right above Winston?
They might be.
The things we don't know.
I really am not sure.
There's some pizza. There's a ukulele. There's half a broom or a whole broom. It's just behind him. And then there's
cowboy boot.
Some eyeballs just.
And doves? Pigeons?
Seagulls? Those are quite hard. They could be seagulls.
Yeah. There is a bird-like creature.
You can see the Golden Gate Bridge in the background, so it wouldn't completely be silly if they were
single. And he's skateboarding across the moon.
Right.
Which is pretty cool. I'm actually going to read the synopsis for this because I don't think we've had... I think this might be the first official synopsis.
Ah, okay.
So, best-selling author Rick Riordan presents best-selling author Stacy Lee's modern reimagining of a classic Chinese folktale replete with magic, boba, and lots of trash talking. I love it already. 12-year-old Winston Chu is supposed to learn impulse control at the cooking academy his mom enrolled him in. But learning to think before he acts won't happen overnight. While skateboarding home with a pie in hand, Winston inadvertently stops a robbery at Mr. Peng's Whimsies, an oddity shop in Chinatown. As a reward, Mr. Peng invites Winston to choose any item in the store. But the strange old man warns Winston to browse carefully, for the first thing Winston touches will be the thing he gets. Before Winston can decide, a magpie flies under a shelf and he impulsively grabs an old broom to sweep it out. Mr. Peng hands him the broom along with a dustpan. 2 for 1. Congratulations. Deflated, Winston returns home, determined to put the broom incident behind him, or at least in the closet. But when some of his most beloved possessions go missing, all Winston can think about are the broom and dustpan. Did they somehow take his stuff? And what or who will they dispose of next? It's time to break into Mr. Peng's Whimsies, where clearly there's more going on than meets the far-seeing eyeball. Maybe it was eyeballs. It's time to fight magic with magic, and this time Winston better have a plan. That is interesting. That is not how I thought that was going to play out.
Yeah, no.
But I am intrigued.
Yeah. It definitely sounds very fun.
Yeah.
Really, really cute.
cool. Excited for that. So again, that comes out February 7th. So you got a little ways, a few more books to read in the interim. Okay, so let's get into our main discussion for today. We are talking about Ballad and Dagger by Daniel Jose Older. We have both read this book. We are going to talk about it in a general overview, and then we will have a designated spoiler section like we have before. And then after that, we will have our interview with Daniel. So that is very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so first up, please check out my full review on subjectifymedia.com. Daniel saw it and he said it was great, so you should read it too.
Is it spoiler free?
It is spoiler free.
Light. Okay, just making sure. So if people were like not sure about the book or wanted to know what it was about, you can check that.
That is a fair point. I usually try to write my reviews spoiler free. There was one recently that I was like, I literally cannot talk about this book except with the spoilers, so, but I put a very clear marker on that one, so there's that. Okay, so general plot kind of stuff for Ballad and Dagger. First of all, this was the first YA book in the imprint, and I feel like you could, like, it was still young. I think that, like, young readers could still enjoy this.
Yeah, it's got the YA feel, and I know why it's YA, but I feel like some younger readers, especially if they're used to reading YA books, I think they could definitely get into this. It
wasn't super dark or super hard to follow or anything
just
like that.
Just that one little bit near the beginning.
Well, yeah. I mean, and after kind that, of a little honestly, bit at the end, too, but, like,
after that, honestly, it wasn't too bad, and then, the ending has a few little darker
it's a
moments.
Little murder amongst friends.
Right? it's just murder.
Yeah, it's fine. But yeah, I could tell why it was YA too, but I think it fits in very well with the other books. It doesn't feel like it really needs to be, you know, in a class of its own, even though it kind of is. But I felt like younger kids and adults could definitely enjoy this book. It was very versatile and very enjoyable overall. Yeah, so I guess, you know, for anybody who's like, I still don't really know what Ballad and Dagger is about, it was very difficult to get it down into, like, just a couple of sentences, because this book is, like, very involved. It's very intricate.
Yeah.
So basically, you have Mateo, and Mateo sees Chela murder someone on the street, and then finds out that he's the initiated son of Galanika, who's like a spirit god in their culture, a spirit.
One of three.
Right, right. Yes. And that basically means he can heal people. So he has the power of healing. There's an attempted coup, crazy monsters, and a lost island threatening to emerge from the sea. And that is, like, the briefest way that I could explain this book. There's so much more.
Oh, yeah. So, so much more.
I read this book a couple of weeks ago so that I could put out my review on the release date, which was May 3rd. And I really liked it. Like, I flew through it. I thought that it was very, like, dynamic. It was really interesting, the world that he had built. It felt really real. It made me miss New York City, which was a feat because New York City is crazy. But a lot of the, like, cultural stuff and kind of, like, when my friends lived in Queens, it just brought back a lot of good memories for me about that. And I thought that was really cool. But overall, I really, really liked it. I think it was a strong start for the YA division of Rick Riordan Presents, and definitely makes me want to read more Daniel Jose Older books, because he definitely has, like, this voice about him that I think is really interesting. But what did you think about it?
I also really liked it. It can be a bit dense at times where there were things going on or concepts being discussed that it took me a minute to kind of be like, okay, I gotta read that again. Like, I just want to make sure I fully grasp what he's talking about, because sometimes he's discussing really broad topics and it takes a minute. Like, so while I definitely think younger readers, you know, people who aren't YA level yet, could definitely read this and get a lot out of it. I think it's one of those that if you read it again later in life, you'll get more and more out of it, because some of it is really deep and really involved, and that really jumped out at me a little bit, because not every, you know, YA book you read has stuff like that. But that definitely hit me from this. I really just loved the completely, like, crazy but really interesting combination of people that make up this community. Yeah. Because it's a whole bunch of different groups of people that shouldn't fit together, but they totally fit together. And it's so funny, and I really loved it. So, yeah. It was a really, really good story.
I mean, let's get into that, because I made a list of characters, and I put San Madrigal down as the first one, because I feel like it's its own character.
It is.
It's such a different concept. So it's a pirate-inspired democracy, first of all, which I kind of loved. And you were talking about, like, all the different groups, and I read this from, I think it was, like, the Amazon page or something like this. Basically, oh no, this was directly from the book. I copied this from the book. It says, made up of Sephardim, which is Sephardic Jews, Santeros, people who practice Santeria, pirates, indigenous people, dispossessed European Jews, freed West Africans, etc. Like, there's more.
Right.
But that's what this entire group is made of. And basically, they all lived on this island together, and the island sank, and then they had to go to Brooklyn, and they kind of set up their own community there.
Yeah.
And they just existed, and they made it work somehow. So you have all these different, what do you call them? It's different religions, it's different ethnicities, it's different nationalities. It's just like everything that you don't think would work, but somehow does, mm-hmm. which I think is a really beautiful representation of somewhere like New York City, where mm-hmm. the cultures Absolutely. Are butted right up against each other, and somehow they mix, and guess they don't always get along, but it is interesting how things blend like that.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I really loved, New York City is the perfect place to set a story like this if you have an island that sunk into the sea and they needed somewhere to go. Mm-hmm. New York City is, might not be the most obvious. Like, you might be thinking, like, another island or, Florida. But who would stay in Florida?
The look on your face when you said that was perfection.
I tease. But yeah, like, New York is the perfect place for them. And I love how they kind of take their little section of New York and it becomes San Madrigal, the sequel. Like, it's like they don't, it's not just like they took over this little area and their community's there and, it is what it is and this is just where we all live, but we're all New Yorkers. Like, no, they're San Madrigalans first. And, maybe get down the line. They're San Madrigalans first, and then they've got their religious or ethnic identities, like pirates or, Jewish or whatever, and then they're New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. Like, it's in there, but it's down the line, because that's not really their true home. And I just, the whole way they've built all of that is really cool.
Mm-hmm. The closest vibe I got out of this, especially in the beginning of the book, as I was trying to find my footing in this world, was actually in the Heights.
It's hard not to think about in the Heights.
It reminded me a lot of how they feel about Puerto Rico and the way that they've transferred a lot of their culture from the island into this little neighborhood and how they interact with each other and stuff. And I think Daniel Jose Older and Lin-Manuel Miranda need to do something together because between just the music stuff in general, I think is really, really interesting. So I would really like to see that.
I mean,
just throwing that out into the universe.
If Disney was going to adapt this and make it a movie or a series or something, I think Lin would be the perfect person to reach out to about bringing some of this music to life, because it is also kind of almost a character all its own. So, yeah, that I agree with you. I think mm-hmm. that would be really cool.
And one of the really interesting aspects in the beginning of the book that you pointed out here was the NYPD just kind of leaves them alone for the most part.
Yeah, I just thought it was a really interesting detail that when they settled into this area, whoever was their leader at the time reached out to the police and basically started a dialogue and kind of claimed this land mm-hmm. and was like, listen, we'll police ourselves. We don't need you. Focus on the other areas of New York that definitely need your attention. We got it here. And there was a line in the toward the beginning of the book that Mateo says something to the effect of, As long as we don't have guns, they stay out of our hair. Like, we can stab and punch and whatever each other as much as we want, and we'll police it ourselves. As long as, you know, nobody brings a gun into our midst, like, they're fine to stay out. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and I love that them showing up toward the beginning is, like, one of the first signs that something's really amiss. Something's going on. And, I thought that was really interesting and cool that, mm-hmm. like, they kind of... They're like, listen, we can handle this.
Yeah.
We'll take care of ourselves.
It's also a good just, like, story device in terms of, like, okay, they got to figure it out on their own. Here's the reason why they're not calling the cops for a murder or something like
right.
that. So yeah. I really like that aspect of it, too. So let's talk about Mateo, because I love him. I would do anything for him. He's great.
He's a delight.
Yes. So he loves music and he loves playing the piano. And the way that he interprets the world through music is so interesting to me. I am not a musical person at all. Kristen is. Music and me, it's like a foreign language. I just don't really get how it works. But the way that he described hearing the city and just like interpreting certain aspects of his life kind of like woke me up to what that must be like. And that was something really special to me that I wasn't expecting to get out of this book.
The way that Daniel has written Mateo's love for music is not just like a person who loves to write music or a person. No, it is a jazz-centered like love of music where you play on the fly, and mm-hmm. like in so many of the scenes where Mateo is actually playing music, he's, you know, leading his friend Tams, who we'll get to in a second, kind of leading them down a musical path, and it's live, and it's, you know, it can go anywhere. So like Mateo's on the piano and he's, you know, putting together a melody that Tams can then hit with the drums and bring, you know, more color and life to it. Mm-hmm. And anyone else they've got, you know, instrument wise with them brings another flavor, and it's very jazzy, but at the same time it's their island style. Like, it's not jazz. It's just that's the nearest thing I can think to kind of describe it. And that, it's so cool. I've always appreciated jazz. It's not necessarily my favorite, but I really, really love how jazz musicians can be live and in the moment, and it never really, like, falls apart. If I was trying to do that, it would be a disaster. because while I love music and I love to sing and all of that, I don't have the ability to riff quite as well as a, you know, an instinctual jazz musician does.
Right.
Like, some people just have that gift, and I really wish I did because it's incredible and it can be so magical. And in here, I feel like this is the closest I've ever experienced to somebody really getting that across,
mm-hmm.
Especially in print. Like, there's no... I even listened to the audiobook a little bit, and there's some, like, you know, music, but it wasn't like, here's all the music, like, we're gonna sing every song and all that. It was just... Yeah, like, you can feel the music coming off the page. Even if you don't know the tune, you don't know what he's doing, you can still feel it, and it's really cool.
The way he describes it, I think, is really unique and just really, he's very good at what he does, basically. Yeah, Mateo, as cheesy as it sounds, like, the music is inside him. He doesn't just love music. Like, it's literally something inside him that he has to let out. And I know a lot of people who are passionate about artwork feel that way, too. Like, I feel that way about writing. You know, I can't really imagine myself doing anything else, even though I complain about it a lot. It is something that is inside me that I have to just get out. And I love that he kind of brought that artistic side to it. It wasn't just like, oh, this character listens to music all the time and relates to the lyrics. Like, no, he creates things himself. And I thought that was really beautiful. He's also very anxious all the time, which I really, really took to. I am also a very anxious person. And the way that Daniel described it and some of the advice that he gave throughout the book really hit me kind of hard. Because I was like, oh, yeah, you know, this makes sense. Like, if it was something Tia Lucia said about, like, fear something with fear and not basically not letting it take a hold of you or something like that. And I was like, I had to sit there for a second and just be like, wow, okay. I didn't really...
I think it was something to the effect of fear is a liar.
Yes, fear is a liar.
Or something like that. And yeah, I remember being really...
Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's so true though. I think that it made Mateo really relatable and kind of gave him this like, I don't even know, like you never can really hold on to him because he's kind of all over the place. He's got a lot of energy and his anxiety really... scares him, but he works through it throughout the book, and I really liked seeing that journey.
Agreed, especially when you compare him or look at him in comparison to the people around him, because his best friend is like, again, we'll get to this, is like this gorgeous creature, and like we'll get to Chela in a minute too, who has this very graceful way about her. And, like, Tia Lucia is not necessarily clumsy or awkward or anxious either. So, like, in comparison to everyone around him, he just feels so incredibly realistic. Uh-huh. Because while there are tons of graceful people in the world, I've never identified as a particularly graceful person. And so I really loved that Mateo, in addition to having, like, anxiety, has just these moments where words don't work for him. Yeah. And so he's just kind of like, burr, burr, burr. Because that is so realistic for me. Like, some days words just fail me and I'm sitting here stumbling. You guys have heard it. Sitting stumbling over a word or can't find what I'm looking for. And that is just so wonderful. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of hard to get that quality across. Like, that, you know, there's so many, especially female characters in, like, romance or whatever, that are, you know, a little bit clumsy or a little bit this, but they always seem to come across as being these, like, graceful people who just maybe stumble a little.
Yeah.
Mateo's kind of a mess.
Yeah, and he's a total mess.
And I love it. Like
it, the way that you described that reminded me of, like, you know, all the 90s movies and the 2000s stuff where it's like, oh, she's ugly because her hair's in a ponytail and she's wearing glasses, but yeah, really she's beautiful.
Right.
Like, a lot of romance characters come off a little two-dimensional like that. But Mateo, like you said, he's a mess. Like, yeah, he's actually a mess. And it makes him really relatable, but I also found it really endearing. Like, it wasn't annoying that he couldn't always say what he wanted to. Like, I find that difficult sometimes. Like, usually I'm like, just say it, you know, Percy and Annabeth, just say what you want to say to each other. But with Mateo, I really felt like where he was coming from, and it was a journey throughout the book that I really appreciated seeing.
Agreed.
So we also find out that he's the initiated child of Galanika, which means that he can heal, basically. He has these healing powers. And I thought that was really neat. I liked the description of, like, the spirits and how they, like, well, worked in this world.
For me, it was the music.
Yeah.
And how music and his healing abilities kind of morph.
Right.
And, like, he uses a tune or something that he hums to, like, send the music into people's bodies, and then he uses that as it, like, runs through them to check what part of them is injured or hurt so that he can help them. And, like, there's just something about that visual that works so well for me, because, like, supernatural healing abilities have a million different, you know, have a million different representations in pop culture. You've got everything from Wolverine, who, like, you know, magically heals himself, and you've got, you know, I can't even think of anyone else.
The White Lighters from Charmed.
There you go. Like, there's all kinds of representations of people who can heal, either themselves or other people, and it comes across in different ways every time. And I just love the idea that his music and his connection to music is how he connects to his healing abilities. It's not that this is the only way that Galanika initiates have ever done this, because I don't think he's the only one. There have been previous ones. They've probably healed in their own ways. Mm-hmm. But for Mateo, music is the connection to his healing abilities. And so he uses the music to run through a person and find, like, mm-hmm, that's so cool. And I can, yeah, see the visual. It's almost like Inside Out, where you, like, run into, yeah, the body and, like, you're, you know, going up to the, like, I can almost feel that. And I'm like, it's just such a cool visual. And I love it so much. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love the healing ability music whole section of this. It's very cool.
Yeah. And when he finally finds that part, it just, like, everything kind of clicks into place. And you're like, all right, this feels right.
Now we're cooking with gas.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the people around Mateo now. First, let's just get to Tams, because I know that you love Tams. And
I freaking love Tams.
Yeah, and want to talk about her. So Tams is Mateo's best friend, and throughout the book, and there's also Mazza and Maybelline, who are twins, mm-hmm. and they're kind of in this group too, but more with Tams than anything else, because Tams has a little crush on Mazza, who uses they-them pronouns, and the twin, Maybelline, uses she-her. So I thought that was pretty cool, and just like, you know, Tams isn't straight either. Like, I think she's had a lot of relationships with women. And
I think Mateo describes it as being, like, Tams is attractive to everyone and is therefore attracted to everyone.
Yeah.
Like, Tams doesn't really have boundaries as a, you know, when it comes to her sexuality or just her interest in other people. Like, she's just, whoever's coming, you know, on to her, she's interested. Let's check it out. Let's see what's going on.
It was a very cool description of pansexuality without actually saying that. Like, if you're unfamiliar with pansexuality, like, I just felt like it was a very natural way to describe it that way. So
absolutely.
I thought that was pretty cool. And Tams plays the drums, and she's
a Tam, like,
yeah,
it's a drum.
Tams, I didn't even put that together.
I just thought it was fun. I was like, oh, that's cool. Yeah. Like, I wonder if that, you know, we never hear another name other than Tams, but I wonder if Tams is short for something.
Yeah.
And because she's a drummer, she's Tams. That's mm-hmm. just it. Because, yeah, but we don't really hear anything about that. We pretty much just know Tams as Tams. Okay, when it comes to, like, book best friends,
mm-hmm.
sometimes they can be a little, I don't know, there are so many great ones, but even they have their moments. Tams never has a moment. Tams is loyal to a fault mm-hmm. and is always there to help
Mateo. I do remember you were saying you were worried.
I was worried. I'm not calling this a spoiler. I'm not trying to spoil anybody. But I worried from with each scene as this book progressed that somehow Tams was going to end up being some creature that was going to cause difficulty for Mateo, or something was going to come true, or she was going to find something out about herself that was going to ruin it, because I love these two together. They have so much, like, they have that perfect banter, witty repartee kind of thing, and, oh, I just love it so much.
It's cool because it's a very platonic relationship, which I always appreciate seeing, and Tams has such a big personality that it really balances Mateo out. I think that she's both the main character in her own story, but also, like, very supportive of Mateo. And it was just a really cool dynamic that I don't think you see all the time. Like, she was kind of a bigger person than Mateo was, but she didn't take any of his spotlight away. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Again, Tams is just such an interesting, fun, like, when we first meet Tams, we don't really get, like, a strong physical description. So I kind of had my own vision of, like, what Tams would look like, which for some reason was really close to Toph from Avatar.
Oh, okay.
Like, I pictured her, like, kind of shorter and, like, a little bit, like, tomboyish. But then, like, a chapter later, we find out that Tams is this, like, gorgeous, perfectly proportioned human and, like, has somehow chosen Mateo to be her friend. And Mateo's like, I have no idea why she hangs out with me. So, like, I had this vision of Tams in my head and I'm like, okay, I have to change a little few things. All right, we gotta kind of, yeah. But it just is one of those things where you initially kind of invent a person before you even know what they look like, and then it's like, oh, okay, all right.
Gotta just erase a couple of lines, redraw it here.
Yeah.
I also really loved Tia Lucia and Aunt Miriam. So Tia Lucia is the one who's alive. Aunt Miriam is the one who's a ghost. And they were married, so they weren't sisters. So again, more queer representation in this book, which, of course, I really loved. And Tia Lucia is a bit of a firecracker. Definitely somebody who doesn't like to tell Mateo what's going on.
She has major Disney grandma vibes.
Yeah.
So many good vibes.
And she can read, like, her little...
shells.
The shells, yeah. She reads the shells and can kind of see the future and stuff. And Aunt Miriam's just hanging out as a ghost. And that was, like, a whole thing. But it was cool that it was kind of just a known thing. It didn't freak Mateo out. It didn't really have too much of an impact on the story. It's just, like, how these two existed. And Aunt Miriam couldn't leave Tia Lucia because she was still so in love with her, and like that was keeping her tethered to the earth, and I really liked their dynamic. And as infuriating as Tia Lucia was sometimes, I think she really was trying to help Mateo walk on his own two feet, which I did appreciate by the end.
Yeah. When it comes to, like, secret keeping, I get it, especially as, like, a part of the plot. Like, I definitely get it. It is frustrating because you're like, just tell them. But it's, in this case especially, I feel like she wasn't completely unwarranted, because as soon as some of her secrets get out, it does absolutely change the focus of the book. It takes Mateo's, you know, train of thought completely changes. Mm-hmm. Now he has a new focus, and it does have a dramatic impact. So I can kind of see why she can't just be straight with him from the beginning, because she knows it's going to change everything he's working toward and everything he's, you know, thinking about and helping with and all of that. So I get it. In this case especially, I get it. There are some things that you just can't tell people until it's the right moment. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those that I 100% am on board. I get it.
Yeah. Fine. You make a good point.
We should also probably really quickly mention farts.
Oh, farts!
He didn't make our doc, but I just remembered farts. Because when it comes to, you've got Tia Lucia, you've got Aunt Miriam, mm-hmm. you also have to mention farts.
Farts the Chihuahua. Whose real name is not Farts, but everyone calls him Farts for the most obvious reason. Yeah, that was
pretty cute. I kind of forgot about farts throughout the book, and then Mateo would go home for some reason, and he'd just say, oh yeah, me and farts, and I'd be like, Oh yeah, I completely kind of forget about him, and then he pops up at the most random times. So yeah. I'm like, that's right. There's a little Chihuahua puppy, I think.
Running around. I imagine farts as the most deranged looking Chihuahua. So my best friend back home had a dog named Hector, and he was a Chihuahua, and he was very old by the end. He was a teacup Chihuahua, so he was even tinier.
Okay.
He was very old by the end, and I think was, like, kind of going blind, and just, like, this dog was nuts, but, like, in the most endearing way. And that's kind of how I imagine farts, is, like, he's just...
just a little bit
insane and...
like Oliver and Company, he's Tito.
Yeah. Actually called Hector Tito because nice. I thought it was a better name. Okay, so let's talk about Sheila Hidalgo, because I love her so much. I am kind of obsessed. In my review, I said she was one of my favorite new heroines, and, like, I stand by that, because mm-hmm. she's a total badass. She's an assassin, despite being, like, 16 years old. And she's the initiated daughter of Okanla. So she basically has this, like, death god inside her.
The Destroyer?
Yeah.
Is, I believe,
her. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, like, a heavy mantle to wear at 16, but she kind of just embraces it. And I think that's the cool thing about Chela, is, like, she's definitely that more modern, strong female character, in that she is very strong, she's very capable, but she's also emotional, and she's vulnerable, and she does worry about things, and she's not two-dimensional at all. And I just really appreciated, especially toward the end when her and Mateo got closer, seeing inside of all of that and just her kind of coming to terms with her legacy and what that means for her, I really, really loved how he handled that.
Oh, agreed so much. Yeah, I also love Chela Hidalgo. Just, God, so much, like, she's not even, like, sassy, but her entire existence is sassy. Like, she's not particularly sassy in how she talks to Mateo. Like, she's honestly very understanding and gives him the opportunity and, like, doesn't rush him and gives him a chance to kind of formulate what he's trying to say. And that's rare because we all want to get to the point most of the time. So, like, that there's that. But, like, yeah, she's just... so cool, and I wish I was that cool, and I don't know. I don't even know what else to say.
I know, me neither.
Chela is just, there's just something about her that is so much fun, and honestly, I think her and Mateo's relationship, and as it evolves throughout the book, is part of what makes her so much fun.
Yeah. Because
I love how they interact.
They balance each other very well. Because she's kind of intense. And I think, like, he reminds her to just, like, calm down for a second, you know? Like she's kind of ready to go off into battle. And he's like, wait, can we just worry about things for a minute? Like, is that okay with you?
Like, not everything has to be at full speed. Yeah. But we can take a second. Because she's also, like, quick as lightning and, like, disappears all the time. And it's like, stop doing that.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you.
I also really appreciated that the cover was a very realistic rendition of what both Mateo and Chela look like. Like, Chela's hair and everything like that. I always appreciate when covers actually show what the characters look like.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, you got, like, I think Mateo's entire face. I think Chela might have been to the side. But you get to see them, and I thought that was, it was really cool that that was on there. She's also the daughter of the rabbi, and she's cousin to Tolo, who is, like, the pirate leader, right? Like,
he's kind of the leader of the pirate gang, but not the leader of the pirate faction.
Right, yeah. He's kind of, like, a gangster, sort of. Like, he's involved in maybe some shady things, but not, like, super shady things.
Yeah.
But I found him very likable, actually. I thought he was interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I really love not just Chela, but her father is actually really cool.
Yeah.
Like, we don't get a ton of him. He kind of steps into a bigger role later in the book. But, like, once you get to know him, like, he's really cool.
Kind of corny, like, dad vibes,
but
too.
But I love that.
Yeah, so do I. So do I.
So much. And honestly, Tolo, you kind of expect something different from, too. And as you meet him, it's like, oh, like, for a pirate gangster, you know, kind of guy, he's actually really approachable and, like, really, you know, like, it's kind of cool.
And intelligent and kind of thoughtful and...
None of them at any point, this is not a spoiler, none of them at any point stop Chela from doing what she needs to do or what she, you know, thinks is best or whatever. They're not trying to stop her from doing this or that. Like, they may not love her choices, but, like, they don't ever physically try and, you know... restrain her, keep her from doing something. If she knows that this is the way it has to be or something she has to do, they let her do it. And that's really cool.
And that's especially big for her father, who doesn't have the best relationship with the rest of the community, and especially with, like, Tolo's parents and stuff and, like, that whole thing. You're right. They don't hold her back, and they really trust her to make her own decisions with her life now that this crazy thing has happened, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
Last character I want to talk about is Herval, who is a world-famous musician who grew up in San Madrigal and basically came back for stuff. And he's Mateo's hero, and Mateo just wants to play with him, and he really looks up to him. And Herval kind of gets thrown into the middle of everything that's going on as well. And not everybody appreciates the fact that he took their culture out into the wider world, which I totally get. Like, I really understand that. So he never really sat right with me for that reason specifically, because I was like, I don't know, I feel like you should keep everything a secret because, like, this world is so cool. Why would you want to, like, risk the outside world influencing that?
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely, I mean, even from the beginning, while he's, you know, Mateo's muse, he's his musical hero, he loves this guy and all of his music. From the beginning, he's kind of painted as a controversial figure in the community, but also even just Mateo describing him, like, he never seems to really 100% get what Herval is up to or what's, you know, what's going on with all of that. And he doesn't really, it's not completely transparent and all of that. So, yeah, Herval is a very complicated character, but definitely important to the story and crazy.
Like, yeah.
He's a little bit something not... even from the beginning, something just doesn't quite sit perfectly right.
Yeah. Let's hold that thought for now, because I want to talk about two other things really quick, and then we'll get into our spoiler section.
Yes.
So, the one huge thing that I wanted to bring up was that this book is full of Spanish. It is English and Spanish switching back and forth, and I loved it. I took Spanish for like 7 years. I haven't, you know, done anything with it in a very long time, but I can read it okay, and I just really love that switching back and forth. And for me, it really brings the culture out of the book, and like people who are bilingual, like this is how they speak a lot of the times, especially with like friends and family. Like you just switch back and forth. Whatever words come out, like usually the person you're talking to is going to understand it. So I really love this. Now you took French, and there are a lot of similarities between Spanish and French, and we can usually figure each other's words out sometimes. But how did you feel about all the Spanish in the book, and did it make it more difficult for you to like see that switching?
I loved the Spanish for, especially for the cultural reasons it's in the book, which, you know, is really cool. It did make a few, there were a few times where I wished there was more of a direct, like, translation or explanation of what was said, because there are a couple of times where I feel like a character uses Spanish and Mateo responds to them, and his response is supposed to be enough to kind of give you the gist without fully explaining it. But there were a couple of instances here and there where I was just kind of like, I really don't know what they said. Like, I have no idea. Yeah. And I wouldn't focus on it. I'd keep moving. And the story is completely understandable without it. Like, it's not anything that's, like, you know, groundbreaking or anything to the story. But there were a few instances where I was like, eh, we kind of wish. But I did not try and Google Translate or anything like that, because I was like, let's just stay in the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll figure it out later.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to say that I think Daniel did a good job of doing enough of those, like, translations within Mateo's discussion, like, within the conversation. Mateo has a really good way of kind of saying, like, no, Tia Lucia, that's not what I was saying. Like, he'll kind of, like, restate what they said in a way that's not unnatural. And that's kind of hard sometimes. So I want to say that Danielle did an amazing job with it. Just occasionally I had a phrase or two where I was like, man, I really wish I know what that's about.
I mean, there were even one or two things that I was like, I'm not sure I know what that means, but it's easy enough to just keep going, and it doesn't, like you said, the story is still very readable, and I really like Daniel's stance on all of that in general, and the fact that he doesn't italicize the quote-unquote foreign words, the non-English words, because everything is, you know, for people who are bilingual, like, this is just natural for them. This is all of their standard, their baseline. And I really appreciated that. And the voice and the dialogue, like you were talking about the banter before, it's so good.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Man, especially that witty repartee between Tams and Mateo, man. I mean, Chayla has a bit of it too, but Tams and Mateo have it down solid. Like, this feels like a friendship that has been building their entire lives, despite the fact that Mateo spent a lot of his time away from the island, away from the community.
Yeah.
You know, despite all of that, like, they're still very close, and it comes across so organically. It's just there, and I love that.
Yeah, definitely. I did not love the monsters. They were kind of scary.
No, yeah. They reminded me a bit of Berserkers.
Yeah, a little bit.
Was my first, like, there's some differences, and they, as they, you know, learn more about these things, you kind of get a better description. But at first glance, that was my, like, comparison. My brain was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
They were a little scary, and I think that's where the book got a little dark sometimes, was like, I was kind of on the edge of my seat a few times, because they were like, I don't want to meet them down a dark alley.
Yeah, no. Plus, I really appreciated the use of, like, what did they call them? The Muerte? Like, there are other ghosts besides Aunt Miriam in the story, and they're talked about as, like, yeah, you know, occasionally you'll see a ghost. It's just what it is. It's part of our, you know, it's part of the thing. It's part of how this all works. But then they're also, like, you know, there's other apparitions and things that just kind of, like, pop up, and none of them question it. It's all just like, okay, so that happened. What does it mean? What do we do with it? Where are we going? Like, I just love that there's this blanket appreciation for all things supernatural and slightly off and a little bit, you know, magical, and they all just take it in stride.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just you're right. Fun.
They are basically like, okay, that was weird. So what do we do now?
Yeah. So okay, how does that change things? Do we need to worry about that? No. Okay. Let's keep going.
Okay. So let's talk about our spoilers now. This is our spoiler section. Neon lights going off.
Stop if you haven't read the rest of the book.
Yeah. Spoilers.
Okay.
Okay. Tia Lucia's death. I was so sad. Like, I knew it was coming. I knew it had to happen.
I think I assumed that it was going to be some natural death that she couldn't help. That, like, okay, in, this is going to sound kind of roundabout, but we're going to get there. In Vampire Diaries, Caroline tries to heal her mother. Her mother has cancer. She tries to heal her mother with vampire blood, and instead of healing her, she speeds the cancer up, because vampire blood speeds up cellular growth.
Oh.
Like, that's how they ended up explaining it. Vampire blood is, you know, prior to this, we had thought of it as a magic cure-all. Like, no matter what injury you have, it fixes you. And that's true. But it's not necessarily a cure-all for everything.
Right.
And I kind of loved how they handled that. Here, I kind of thought that Mateo's healing powers are not a cure-all for everything. Again, that he can heal people, he can fix things that are wrong, but it doesn't necessarily mean he can, like, destroy cells or whatever, especially at the beginning of his healing. Because later on in the book, we learn that he's got more power to him than we know. But especially toward the beginning, that was kind of how I understood it. So I thought when she told him, you know, I'm going to die, I thought it was going to be something he wouldn't be able to stop. No, it's not really that. It's that she's not going to be physically where he is to be able to stop it.
It was a little more violent than I was expecting.
Yeah.
And speaking of his healing ability and everything, and, like, taking that, like, shard of death inside of him and all of that, I was, like, very surprised that Daniel went in that direction, because it felt darker than I thought Mateo was, but he's also grieving, and I think it makes sense to kind of, like, have to deal with that, but I was really afraid, like, Mateo's gonna go off the deep end at one point, and I was like, what is happening?
When he said, like, I held that darkness inside of me, and it felt right, and I was like, why does it feel right? Mateo, this should not feel right. Mateo, you should be concerned about this. Like, I was freaking out. Like, I'm not okay with this. Tia Lucia, make him get rid of it. Like, yeah. You know, because it's all, like, very complicated. But I love that you get Tia Lucia teaching him how to clean himself of all of this, only to find out that holding onto it is a whole different aspect of his power.
Yeah, that, like, was awesome.
I don't think she was trying to keep him from it. Mm-hmm. I think she didn't fully understand what he was capable of.
Yeah.
And him kind of understanding it later is a whole different thing.
Yeah. I mean, taking somebody's injuries, keeping it inside yourself, and then throwing it at somebody else to take them out is, like, that's really powerful and interesting, and I loved it, even though it was, like, a little scary sometimes.
Oh, yeah. But very intense and different and interesting, and I was into it.
Yeah, so was I. Mateo and Chayla's kiss. So tender. Like, I wasn't expecting it to be that soft and tender because she is kind of intense because they weren't, like, enemies or anything, but they were kind of up against each other for a lot of the book where it was, like...
just combative friendship.
Yeah, like, you have your way, I have my way. They don't always sync together. And, like, we don't have any animosity for each other, but, like... we're not always on the same page. And then when they do get on the same page, like her walking into the room in all white and everything, I was like, I felt like a goddess was entering the room. Like, it was so cool.
And it kind of was.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of was. Yeah.
I mean, at that point, we kind of know. Yeah. No, I 100% agree. The build-up between these two was, like, chef's kiss. Mwah. It was perfect. Because you get the beginning where Mateo kind of watches her murder someone. And then is like, but I'm attracted to her.
Yeah.
And can't stop thinking about her. Mm-hmm. And is like, you know, it's like the beginnings of a crush where you know this person. You've known this person for a long time. But suddenly seeing them in this slightly different way.
Right.
Like, makes you kind of... question, like, what do I feel? How do I feel about this person? And then all of a sudden, Tams is onto it and is like, oh, so you've got a thing for the assassin lady. And it's like, no, I totally don't. What are you talking about? Some of my favorite scenes in this book are Tams ribbing Mateo endlessly for his feelings about Chayla. And it's so perfect because it's exactly the kind of teasing friends do. And it's so, like, warm hearted, but also hysterical. Yeah. And I love it. But yeah, these two, when they finally have a moment to kind of just be together and accept that, yeah, we both have feelings for each other. This is, you know, we need to stop denying it. It is what it is. And I love that in that moment also, Tia Lucia, like, lets her be there. Like, there's no, like, this is inappropriate or you shouldn't, you know. There's none of that, which you could have fit into the story. It could have worked. But I love that Tia Lucia, I think... she just saw that there's something between these two that is different, and I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna stand in the way of that, especially with everything going on. Right. So, yeah, it's such a sweet scene, and them, like, cuddling on the couch.
Yeah.
And
I think you're right. The build-up to them was very smooth, and I didn't feel like anything was taken away by the fact that they didn't, like, come together and then get broken apart, and then, you know, like, there wasn't a lot of that weird animosity that sometimes happens between couples before they finally figure things out. And maybe that'll be part of their journey in the second book or something. But for now, I just thought it was like a very smooth transition between practical strangers to, oh, wait, I think we're kind of friends now, to like, wait a second, we both feel this way about each other, and them kissing. And like, it was very nice, very sweet.
There is a little bit of the like misunderstanding trope in this, where there's some things that are interpreted incorrectly and it kind of drives them apart a little, not for very long.
Yeah.
And while that is usually one of my least favorite tropes, especially in romance, like, I can handle it in small doses, but if it's a big part of the plot, it kind of drives me away. Here, I think it worked exactly how it was supposed to. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can't get away from it. There's going to be misunderstandings between people, and I like that it didn't color the entire story. It was just... it was something that happens, and you just deal with it, and then you move on. Yeah. And, yeah.
So. I think that's why it didn't bother me either, because, like you said, it doesn't color the entire story. It's just one small aspect of it that gets resolved fairly quickly. So.
Agreed. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. One of the other big moral lessons in this book is the fact that San Madrigal is both a paradise and a flawed creation. And, like, he went there with it. He was basically like, yeah, so we're, you know, an island nation full of people from Africa. And, you know, they have, like, a Spanish influence. And, like, if you're in the Caribbean, there's all kinds of people there. And they thought they were above the slave trade. And it turns out that they're not. And that explains a lot of the colorism that Mateo points out in the beginning of the book. And I really liked that. I thought it was something very deep and mature for this book to tackle. And I appreciated that Daniel didn't, like, pull any punches with it. Like, he, like, laid it down and was like, yeah, you know, white people have a lot of problems, but we have a lot of problems too. And it's all related and it all influences each other. And I think that kids of all races reading this are really going to pick up on that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's part of what makes San Madrigal so vibrant and interesting is that you've got all these very different cultural belief systems coming together. And, like, I think one of the ones that sticks out most in my brain that I love is between Mateo and the rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
And when Mateo's like, okay, but you're, like, Jewish. Like, you believe in one God. Like, how can you also believe in the three gods that make up San Madrigal's, you know,
right,
history? Like, how can you believe in both? And he goes, we only have one God, but we have many angels.
Yeah.
Like, angels of destruction and angels of, like, I love that they're able to see the differences and just make them work. Like, it's not that the rabbi agrees that these are other gods, but he also doesn't correct everyone every time they say
right.
that it's, you know, the god of this or the god of that. Like, he just knows that in his belief system, they're basically angels. They're a part of the entire thing. And it's just cool that they don't need to constantly be telling each other that they're wrong or whatever. It's just they each understand their own belief system and how the island works, and it all just works. And that's just really cool.
Yeah, I completely agree. I always think it's very interesting when, you know, Daniel Jose Older comes from that same sort of background where it's got a lot of different influences, and you can tell he's brought this to the book. And I always find it very interesting how those things can, like I was saying before, just blend together so seamlessly. And, like, you know, you probably do have people butting heads every once in a while, but, like, you just accept the other person as a person.
Yeah.
And accept your differences and then relate to the similarities. And, yeah, I really appreciated that.
And I think Mateo is pretty realistic about it, too. Like, we still have people fighting in the streets all the time.
Yeah.
And there's disagreements, but for the most part, everyone kind of just, you know, has this general, you know, accepting. But, of course, you've got feuding factions and people that are fighting. It's, you know, any community has those people, too. So he's mm-hmm. like, we've got all kinds. And, yeah, just very cool.
Yeah. And speaking of all kinds, mm-hmm. I don't think it was that surprising that Herval ended up being Visvargal. Because
yeah.
I kind of saw that coming from the beginning, and I wasn't sure if it was going to happen. Like, there were a few times where I was like, well, maybe he won't be, like, the bad guy, but he's definitely involved with something.
I will admit to not having any clue whether it's going to be Tolo or Herval who's going to end up being the bad guy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, until Herval kind of steps forward and starts being more proactive in his villainy mm-hmm. a little. You don't get, like, a major signal. Daniel did a good job of keeping it ambiguous for a good amount of the book. Mm-hmm. And then when it has to, you know, when we have to see Mateo either taking a side or, like, choosing a side, it happens very quickly.
Yeah.
And then from then on out, it's pretty clear where the battle lines are.
Yeah. And it also, you know, one of the greatest twists of this book was the fact that the creator spirit and the destruction spirit were the same person. They're yeah. both in Chela.
Yeah.
And it very much reminded me of Teka yeah. and Tafiti.
Yes.
Yeah. It reminded me of that because they're the same person, too. Spoiler alert for Moana. And
we're in the spoiler section.
Yeah. Yeah. All spoilers for everything. Go here. And so you're really waiting for... The third one is San Madrigal, right? Like, that's the creator spirit's name?
Yeah, it's supposed to be.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So you're kind of waiting for this third person to pop up as the creator spirit, and then turns out, like, that's not the case at all, but then you get Herval coming out as Visvargal, who is a very scary demon-y kind of god that yeah. they trap underneath the island.
With extra arms.
Yeah, it's a bit insane.
Why didn't we get extra arms? Sorry, I just love that scene.
And I guess, like, you know, this kind of does bring us to the end of the book where Mateo and Chela start seeing visions. They start experiencing the past and they see what happened on the island and the fact that they, you know, collapsed the island to get rid of this demon-y guy. And I thought that was really interesting. And this book, for me, started out very narrow, very like, here's Mateo and his very normal problems. And then each step gets bigger and bigger and bigger until by the end, he feels like a reincarnated god going home, and he feels timeless. He feels ancient in a way. This little 16-year-old boy, full of anxiety, all of a sudden is so much bigger than himself. And it really resonated with me for some reason. Like, it really just hit me in a way that I, like, had to take a step back and go, wow, like, everything's kind of been leading up to this point. And I just really appreciated the direction it all took.
I agree. This is probably the section of the book that I think would be hardest for a younger reader, mm-hmm. Or even some YA age readers to really grasp fully, because it is kind of abstract and it's out yeah. there and it's not easy to kind of nail down, but beautiful, honestly beautiful. I think the thing about it that I like the most is that despite the fact that both Chela and Mateo are also these gods that everyone's been talking about, they're not just initiated into them, they like are them. Mm-hmm. They're also still Chela and Mateo.
Yeah.
Like, because that, I think, when you hear about a character actually being another character, like, you know, spoiler alert, you're actually the stepbrother of this person, and, like, completely changes the whole tone of a story because now you've got this different relationship, or, you know, you're secretly the father, you know? Like, when you learn that Darth Vader is Luke's father, it changes the entire
spoiler
story.
Spoiler alert for Star Wars.
Right? We're just throwing all the spoilers out today. But, like, it changes the
yeah,
whole story.
You're right.
So, like, it could have really altered all of the relationships in the story to do this. But he writes it so well that Mateo never stops feeling like Mateo. Mm-hmm. Chela never stops feeling like Chela. It's just they are also these other beings.
I think it feels very much the same way it does with his music, is like it was inside him all along, basically.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was. It literally was because he was initiated as a child. But that's sort of like it's this unveiling rather than this like actual change. Like
right.
He steps into this role that he was always going to step into and that was there inside of him all along.
Well, and like when they're in their like godly forms, kind of looking back on the past and experiencing their previous connections and all that, we learn that these bodies that they're inhabiting are not bodies they inhabited, they're their bodies. So, like, Mateo was always meant to be Galenica. This body was formed with the intention of being Galenica's human self. Same with Chela and Okanla. It's the same thing. Like, they wanted to be human. They wanted to take human form and experience the world in that form. And so they did it. It's not like, you know, this poor baby was inundated with a godly spirit or anything like that. It's like, this is actually designed. They wanted to take this form and experience life in this form. And I just think that's really cool, too. Because so many of these stories, it's like, oh, well, I was initiated and the spirit came to me and I then took it in and blah, blah, blah. Like, no, this was literally designed mm-hmm. this way. And I just think that's an extra cool little, you know, nugget of fun.
And the end of the book where the island starts rising out of the ocean and they're on the boat heading toward the island, the idea that the island could be full of all these monsters and stuff like Book two, I'm so excited for it because it's going to feel like a completely different story. I mean, it's all, you know, we'll have the same characters, the same world building and everything, but going from the city to the island where this world is a lot more real, and it was already very real, but now things are a little bit different with all these monsters and stuff, and they're going to have to figure out what to do next. I'm really excited for it.
I just want Tams to have some crazy weapon or something.
Yeah.
Like, this will even it out. And, like, I just, I'm so excited to see where it goes from here. But yeah, I think Daniel set himself up so well for all kinds of things to go next. And it's really a really cool ending.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Daniel, let's jump right into our interview, shall we?
Enjoy, guys.
All right. So today we are joined by Daniel Jose Older, the author of Ballad and Dagger, the very first young adult book to come out of the Rick Riordan Presents imprint. It hit store shelves on May 3rd, and we just had our very own discussion of the book previous to this interview. And Daniel has agreed to let us ask him some questions today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it is my great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So we've split up our questions into some different sections, and I'm going to let Kristen kick us off with the first set.
Great. Okay. So part one is writing process and just how you get into, you know, into the process. Are there any quirky or fun things you do when you sit down to write? Anything about your process that might be different from how others typically get words on the page?
One thing, well, recently, because I have a baby, I've been just trying to stay up later than everybody else in the house to actually get writing done. So that's become a new quirk of my process. The good thing about that is I kind of was trained through my other careers and my entry into writing to be able to be a little bit light on my feet and nimble around when I sit down and write and how and what the circumstances are. Because I was a paramedic when I was starting out writing, I would actually go into the back of the ambulance, lay down on the stretcher with my laptop and get words in between calls, like in between like heart attacks and earaches and gunshots and all the other nonsense that we dealt with. So, I was already, and then later I would be on tour for one book and on deadline for another. So I would learn, sort of taught myself by necessity how to write in hotel rooms, on airplanes, and even in taxi cabs, although I'd never want to do that again. So that was all good practice, but there's nothing like having a kid, as any parent will tell you. So that's been part of it. The other thing I try to do, particularly with Ballad and Dagger, is I do have a playlist for that book. And it really, really has helped me, especially because while I was writing it, I was jumping back and forth between San Madrigal, the world in this book, and Star Wars. And like writing for Star Wars, it's like a whole other, you're literally in a galaxy far, far away. And it's a different mindset. And so I had to really, I used the playlist very strategically to get myself back into the zone. And then the last thing I'll say is sometimes if I'm really like, if I know I'm kind of off or just not, or just in a different zone in terms of my brain space, I will try to like either journal or just play a song from that playlist and really like sit and listen to it. If not the whole way through, like a bunch of the way through, and just stop, not. Like it can be dangerous to run directly from like errands and chores and paperwork into the writing mode because, it's a different part of your brain that's at work and you have to do a little bit of a reset. So whatever that might mean for you can be helpful.
Yeah. I mean, runners have to stretch before races, between races, and cool down after. So that makes sense. You kind of got to, prep your brain to move into a different activity. It totally makes sense.
Yeah.
So what are your go-to snacks when you're writing?
I don't snack a lot when I'm writing. I mostly because I don't want to get all the crumbs on my keyboard. And like I do, because when I do snack, it's like wasabi peas.
Oh, okay.
And they leave residue. Like there's no way that's not. And then it's like, do you have a napkin nearby? I don't know. It just gets complicated. So I tend to not snack. I do enjoy coffee and green tea a lot.
Very good. Very nice. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Ballad and Dagger is as much about music as it is magic. And you have a background as a musician yourself. You kind of mentioned the playlist. So do you listen to music while you write, or is it just as like an entrance to it? And have you ever composed songs to go with any of your books?
I do listen to music while I write, and I struggle when I don't. Like there's times when if the baby's sleeping or different things, like I'll just not have music on. And I find my brain really just trying to get it into gear does not. It's that much harder. So I find music really fundamental to the writing process in terms of entering that kind of flow state that you it helps to be in when you're writing. I have written the one song I wrote recently. I'm mostly out of my songwriting phase currently, but what I did do recently, there's a really creepy lullaby in some of the Star Wars storytelling that we're working on for the High Republic. And it's kind of a through line throughout a lot of the stuff we're working on. And so I really wanted to hear it. And I knew it would be sort of straightforward to write, So I did sit down and put that into music. And then I actually posted it on TikTok and they did a sing along where each person is adding a different part of the song, which was really cool. So that was a lot of fun.
That's cool. Yeah. Okay. Last question in this section is what editing critique or comment do you most dread seeing after a first draft?
That's a good question. I think that's a really tough one. It's a really interesting question. There are definitely comments I'm like, oh God, like I'm trying to think of what they are. You know, there's different stages of editing. And when in that first round is when you're kind of making what we call, you know, global changes and moving bigger parts of the story around. And then as you move forward, you know, you're getting into more and more minutia. And it's actually the minutia that I kind of hate the most. In terms of process, like I'm glad that there is an edit for minutia exactly for that reason, because I don't like it. So I'm not good at it all the time. But that's where I get really aggravated, is just like the bouncing constantly through the document and being like, oh, is it this, is it that, like just forever. It feels so never ending. And that's the hardest part. Like I'm a Capricorn. We like to have things finite and clear and know when it's going to begin and when it's going to end. If nothing else, so we can plan, you know, our day or whatever. Like, but editing on that level, it just goes on and on and on. And you're just like, ah, I'm in the swamp no matter what. Like it's just hard to get out. So that's the part of editing that I struggle with the most.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Karen's a writer. She gets it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Editing is the worst.
It's really hard. Like, right. Yeah. I don't know. Some people love it. Some writers love editing.
I love editing other people's stories. That's fun.
Oh, yeah. Totally. That's a different. Yeah. That's a very different vibe for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to pivot into some Ballad and Dagger questions now. In Rick's introduction to the book, he talked about how it was a dream come true to work with you. And you've had some pretty kind words to say about him as well. What was it like joining the Rick Riordan Presents family?
Oh, man, it was something I've just always wanted to do since it came out. I was like, oh, this is perfect. I love the philosophy behind it. You know, I love Rick's work, obviously. And I love that he really took the step to, you know, use his platform in a way where he wasn't speaking for other people, but giving them room to speak themselves. And I think that's just like really a great model of how we move forward, you know, as a culture, like really. So I loved it and I wanted to be part of it. I was also in the middle of a couple other series that I had to wrap up before I could jump to something else. So the timing actually worked out perfectly. And this was pitched to them. Ballad and Dagger was initially a middle grade book because that's all they were doing at the time. And I didn't think they had YA on their radar. And the story to me initially was a middle grade story. It was called Matteo Matisse Monster Murker. And it had a much younger vibe to it. And
Awesome title.
Thank you. It would have been cool too. He just goes around murking monsters, you know, but I'm so happy that it became a YA because that's really what ended up ultimately expanding the universe into what it became, which is infinitely more complex. And I just love that happened.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The cover for this book is phenomenal, by the way, especially because Matteo and Shayla are portrayed exactly how they're described in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that process and how you reacted the first time you saw it?
Yeah. Irving Rodriguez, shout out to him. I think I have that name right. He's incredible. He really just nailed it throughout. The first thing I did actually was make a Pinterest board of vibes, you know, just vibes, just Outlaw Saints vibes. So it was a lot of Sephardic cultural stuff, Santeria stuff, pirate stuff, obviously, and then a lot of Brooklyn and modern day Brooklyn. And putting all those things together really helped me. And then I passed it on to the publishers so they could get a sense of what I was talking about. And then I kind of sent a list of stuff that I hope to see on the cover, mainly Matteo and Shayla. And, you know, and then in some kind of action pose, you know, Shayla with a knife, obviously, like a big dagger.
It's kind of important, yeah.
Yeah. And then just the sense of a larger mythology around them, like the symbolism. There's so many rich symbolism traditions in this book. I just wanted to draw on them to kind of invoke the magic and the culture. And that's what they did. They sent me a sketch back. And it was very close to the actual picture you see. I just had a couple notes about certain things. I was like, you know, make the candles fatter, basically. in the first draft, they looked more like Sabbath candles. And the ones we use in ceremony for Santeria stuff are like the 7-day candles you buy in corner stores. And it's like those, that that level of detail was like in the first round of notes, which means you're really close. And right. then they basically sent me the finished draft and it was perfect.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. You've said in the past that Ballad and Dagger is the book of your heart. What was mm-hmm. the hardest part about writing this story and what was the easiest?
Interestingly, I think the easiest was, in a weird way, the easiest and the hardest maybe were the same. Because like the world building, right? Like I did research. On the one hand, I did a lot of research and I went deep with in deep dives in a lot of different things. Pirates, you know, Jews in the Caribbean, Santeria stuff, all sorts of things. On another hand, all of it is cultures that I'm very familiar with and live in many ways and in other ways not. And so it was kind of this dual thing of like being like the very familiar and then also the very not familiar and kind of having to bring those two things together and figure out how they could work on the page. The world building is so complex that it was a challenge to get it clear without like just being boring, you know, like without being like, without belaboring the point, but also like have it clear on the page and keeping the story moving the whole time.
And much of this book is about Mateo overcoming his fears and anxieties. And that really hit me very personally as a very anxiety riddled person. Mm-hmm. And you impart some really fantastic wisdom on your readers. Is any of that from your own personal experience?
Oh yeah, all of it, definitely. I mean, I always tell like writers, students and anyone writing who asks my advice that listening is the most important thing a writer can do. So that's, you know, for that to be kind of to Lucia's like main tagline that she's trying to impart to Mateo and he's not hearing her for so much of the book is very much like what, that's what I had to learn. Like, I don't just say that as a teacher. I say that as someone who has had to learn how to listen over and over in life. And what is life if not learning how to listen to yourself, to the world around you, to the people that are important to you? We have to listen to each other and not in a passive way, right? Like in a very active way. And I think that's particularly what's required of us as creatives telling stories is that we listen. So, you know, figuring that out as a life lesson and as a writing lesson is, you know, is truly a turning point for me and an ongoing one. And so it felt really right that a book that's this personal and close to my heart would have a truth like that kind of imbued in it.
Well, it definitely landed with me. So
I'm happy to hear that. Thank you.
Okay, so last question for this section. We heard from your interview with Rick that Leigh Bardugo actually helped you come up with the title Ballad and Dagger. How are you doing with the title for book two?
I'm very happy that I didn't have to hit her up this time. As much as I love talking to Leigh, and we talked about other things in the course of it, but I didn't have to run crying to her about, please find my title for me. Which I didn't exactly do that, but you know, it was a process for book one. Book two, it happened much more smoothly. I can't say the title, but I can say that it partially came from the editors. The editors brought me part of it and I added one more word and then we were all like, that's it. And it just landed.
That's awesome.
It when it just works like that.
Yeah, right? Me too. And I didn't know if it would. You know, there's always the question of book two, like, do you continue the pattern? Is it bump and bump or is mm-hmm. it something totally different? And we shall see.
Yeah. So, okay, you can't tell us the title, which is totally fair. Is there anything you can tease us about book two?
Yes. It takes place. It begins 1 second after book one ends.
Okay.
Ooh.
So that's exciting. And there is another POV in it.
Oh,
so that's exciting. And I will also tell you that it was a hard book to write. It kicked my proverbial butt in every way. I struggled to write it. Not like the words weren't coming out, just that it's every book is hard to write. This was particularly so, in part just because the characters go through a lot and you really do, you know, especially these guys, I've really come to love them and care about them, even though they're fictional. It's hard to like be so present with them and be kind of inhabiting their bodies while they're suffering, you know? And, but that's what was required for this book to work. And so that's where we had to go. But it's also just really an exciting book in a lot of ways for reasons that are spoilery for book one too. So I can't say that, but I had a lot of fun writing it too. And that's, you know, it's both.
Yeah. We were just talking about how that like final scene at the end of book one, we were like, want to know what happens next. So I'm really excited that it takes place 1 second later.
It leaves you in such a good place to start the next adventure. And that's really exciting to hear that it just kind of picks up right where you left off. Here we go.
That's the challenge, right? Is like in a series, especially, it's like you want finality, but you also want an open door for the next book. But without making it, because I hate when I finish a book and it just feels like all of that was to get us to book two. So there's no finality for book one. And you're like, well, but what about, it's a challenge. Like you just got to figure out how best to like strike that balance.
Okay. Stepping out of that and into some fun stuff, because that's always a great way to close an interview. If you could choose your godly parent from Greek mythology, who would it be?
I think it would be Mercury. Hermes.
Is that Hermes?
Mercury in Latin. Hermes. I love messenger spirits and tricksters. And he's kind of like, he's a little bit in that, like he can inhabit all the different worlds and realms and move between them, kind of like Mateo. And I respect that.
I gotta throw it out there. I think Apollo would also be a great fit for you.
Oh, really? Oh,
because he's both the god of healing and of music.
True.
You would definitely be Mateo's godly parent.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting. Absolutely.
Okay. What's one other Rick Riordan Presents book or world that you would love to live inside?
Oh, Arusha for sure. Like,
yes.
Roshni did such an amazing job on those books, and everything she does is awesome. So that's definitely my pick.
Yeah.
But they're all amazing.
I've only read book one. Karen's read them all, and I'm very excited to get into the rest of the series. That's a cool world.
It is such a vibrant world.
Yeah.
Is there a Star Wars story that you personally wish Disney Plus would bring to the small screen next?
Besides the High Republic adventure?
Which would be awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I would definitely like to see that. Let's see. Outside, I know like we've been to Tatooine a lot already, but I still love Tatooine and particularly Jabba's Palace. And I know we've even spent a lot of time there with Book of Boba Fett, but I guess maybe in the era before it got kind of vacated, there's so many cool creatures in that part of the world and in that moment in Star Wars that I just feel like there's so much exploring to do in Jabba's Palace, like in the height of Jabba's reign. It'd be really cool to see more of that.
And I feel like that would be a bit of a different Star Wars story too.
Yeah, definitely.
Like it would be similar, it would fit, but it would be a little different, which would be cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And what's the best book you've read lately?
Oh, I'm in the middle of The Witchlings by Clarabelle Ortega, and it's amazing. That is
everywhere on my like Twitter. I want to read it so badly.
Yeah, she's so great.
So final questions here. I know this one might be a little hard because it seems like you've already done so many amazing things, but is there a dream project that you'd really like to work on next?
That is a hard question. I don't know the answer to that. This was kind of the dream project, actually. I feel like my whole career has honestly, and that sounds like a brag. It is a brag. My whole career has been dream projects. Like I remember early on in my career when I was trying to, and this is something I recommend any writer do, really, it's important to define success for yourself and make that an ongoing conversation that you have with yourself, because the last thing you want is to actually be successful, not realize it because you were so busy pursuing someone else's dream. So I remember early on being like, you know, what's success going to look like for me? And it was the definition has always been being able to do the work I want and have it support me and the lifestyle that I'm living. And I've always done the work that I want to do. I've always done these projects that I just didn't even think were possible sometimes because they weren't, or there weren't things that I was seeing on the shelf. And so I would try to get them on the shelf and make that the work I do. And I've been able to do that constantly throughout my career, whether it's Shadow Shaper or Dactyl Hill Squad, a series about dinosaurs during the Civil War, or this project, which is so much about my life in different ways. And so, I find myself jumping from one dream project to the next, and that's the best possible career.
That's some fantastic advice anyways, defining success for you. I definitely think that everybody should do that. Okay. So other than the sequel to Ballad and Dagger, what other kind of projects do you have coming up?
More Star Wars is ahead, which is always exciting. High Republic is entering into its phase two. in the fall, and I have graphic novels on the way, and they the continuation of the adventure series, which is really exciting. Outside of that, I have a graphic novel that's my own work with a co-writer, Malik Duncan, called Death's Day, that comes out, I think, next year from Abrams Books. And it's about death returning to the world every 1,000 years to spend one day with its only child. Aww. And the child is then kidnapped, and they have to go on the hunt to find out what happened and who took the kid. So that's a lot of fun.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm really excited about that. It's a really cool story. And again, that's a graphic novel, a single graphic novel all about itself that comes out hopefully next year, but it's on the way out.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much for talking to us today. This was a lot of fun, a lot of really cool insight. We absolutely loved Ballad and Dagger, and I'm even more excited for the sequel, which I didn't think was possible.
Thank you so much.
yeah, we really appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
All right.
Fiend. I didn't know how to end that.
No, no awkward. Problem. No, that's perfect.
Well, that wraps up our interview with Daniel Jose Older. That was pretty exciting.
Yeah, it was really fun. He's really cool.
Yeah, and I'm really glad we got to talk to him about Ballad and Dagger, and can't wait for book two.
I know, right? Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com, and we love hearing from you, so please reach out. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and that is so cool. You can leave us questions and comments in any of these places, plus ideas for content you might want to see or anything we've forgotten. Please feel free to let us know. We do have some feedback this week. We got a Facebook message from Megan. Karen, do you want to take this one?
Yes. Megan says, "Hi, I'm finally caught up on your amazing podcast. I saw this and thought how it's just like the octopus in Daughter of the Deep. They just love to play." And she sent a little video of an octopus playing with like somebody's camera and stuff, yeah, and just being obsessed with it. And I thought that was really cool, and I watched the whole thing and I enjoyed it a lot. And also thank you, Megan, for your kind words, because
it was very cute.
That makes me feel awesome.
I watched it too, and yeah, yes, I also appreciate your kind words, but I watched it too, and it was really, really cute, and the little octopus kept trying to drag the camera back to its home, and it yeah, was so cute. I love it so much. Should we link to that in the show notes? Should we share that with the world?
I might be able to do that.
We'll try.
Facebook is weird sometimes about what yeah, you can like link to, yeah, so
we'll try. Yeah, we'll try to share this little adorable.
I might be able to find it on YouTube or something.
Yeah, because it's so cute. Anyway,
it is cute.
We also got a tweet from Ian Davies who says, "I just listened to episode 12 of Prophecy Podcast, and now I want to watch the movie again just to moan along with you. Great review. I like you going back and forth with Rick's blog too."
And that was about the first movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He listened to the episode and watched Lightning Thief, and yeah, we definitely had some some comments. But it's, again, it's fun to kind of go back and watch it and look at all the rough spots, and then, you know, with this new adaptation, hopefully there'll just be excitement, yeah, and no more moaning.
No rough spots.
No rough spots. Rick will take care of that. Yeah. So, yeah, just thanks for listening and watching along. That's good fun. All right, next week we'll return to doing our chapters for Battle of the Labyrinth. So make sure you read those, because we took a little break this week, but next week we'll be right on our stuff. And we also will be doing our What If Season 3 for Titan's Curse.
Yes.
And thank you to our listener who pointed out that we forgot. We thanked you last week, but I'm saying it again. Yes. Thank you, because we didn't want to forget this. So if you have any What Ifs for Season 3, feel free to send them our way. And we will include them in the feedback section next podcast.
Yes.
Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.